Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'm so happy now to welcome back to the show Pat Mora. She is an author and poet, and her latest book is called Zing, 7 Creativity Practices for Educators and Students. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. I'm delighted to be back.
So this is a book that we are talking about now, kind of in celebration of the beginning of the new school year. Now, creativity, at this point in history where there are so many schools, well, from the national level down to the local level, so many schools and school teachers and curricula are focused on test scores, not necessarily letting somebody find their own individual voice.
Well, that was one of the challenges, I think, you know, sort of at this time in history of placing a book like this. And that's why I will always be grateful. You know, authors are always grateful to their publishers, and I have worked with many. And I'm very grateful to, in this case, the editor. Not enough is sometimes said about editors, but the editor, Dan Alpert, who saw the manuscript, believed in it, went in there and championed it, you know, because he felt that, indeed, there were teachers and librarians and the general public who probably, many of us have a little bit of a hankering to let, you know, our more what we call creative side out.
And the thing that I was thinking about while looking at this book, which has stories of, well, from your own life and your children and school children and all kinds of people, it's sort of very wide-ranging in the stories that you tell, is that the intellect and creativity are not and should not be divorced from one another.
Absolutely. And I think a lot of the more recent research, you know, in sort of brain science is that though we used to talk a lot about, well, first of all, we never talked about right brain, left brain, and then those two became kind of trendy. But how indeed there's sort of movement back and forth between, you know, the more number-oriented part of our brains, the logical, the well-ordered, and the parts of our brains that perhaps like flights of fantasy, that are willing to be a little more exploratory. My concern is that we not squelch that side of ourselves. That I think is, you know, for each of us, part of the uniqueness that we bring to the universe.
And so there are a number of practices that you talk about in this book, 1 through 7, and one of them is simply, the first one is valuing your creative self. Now, that's something that's tricky because there are people, and you find them even among teachers and certainly among students, who say, well, I'm not creative.
Right.
And they say, oh, I'm organized, but I'm not creative.
Exactly, exactly. And I find that as true among professors, you know, as I do among first grade teachers. And I think it's that, you know, self-doubt, that we don't rid ourselves of self-doubt until death, I think. You know, we all have things that we have doubts about. For some people, it's public speaking, and for other people, it's salsa dancing. And there are all kinds of ways that we feel inhibited. But I think there are some major ways that, you know, sort of streams of ourselves, if you will, that we do need to release, both to make ourselves happier, but also, as I say in the book, because I think when we honor our innovative side, we have more to give the people around us, and that could be family, friends, it could be students, it could be patrons, you know. So it's that uniqueness that sort of fascinated me, and the persistent question on the part of professors and teachers and librarians, you know, tell me how you do it. I want to do it. My friends don't know it. Often they would say it to me, you know, in private. You know, nobody on the faculty knows that I write. I'd really like to publish a book. Tell me how to do it.
Interesting. Well, and so there are some people who are closet writers whose creativity is flowing, but they don't put it out. And then there are other people who have it sort of bottled up inside. And as you say, and I think this is very important, is that creativity is not just poetry, painting, art, and music. I mean, it's in a lot of ways, it's the way you live your life. It's for teachers, it's the way they organize their classroom, even how they respond to a particular student.
I mention in the book, an art teacher in North Carolina who had had students doing problem solving before my visit, in the sense of they were going to put up some works based on some of my children's books. And so the kids were going to draw them, but they also needed to mathematically figure out how big is this poster going to be. And, you know, they were going to do some murals in the cafeteria before I got there. So how big does it have to be? How are we going to do the measuring? And she said to me, you know, I get so frustrated when people talk about testing, because if we're teaching right, students are problem solving all the time, all different kinds of problems, and they will come up with wonderful solutions if, and this is a big theme through the book, if they are in a climate that is both respectful of them, curious about them, you know, that's what lets young people, and that's in a family too. You know, we know that there can be someone in the family that others have gotten used to teasing, and oh, that's so-and-so. And yet that person has unique gifts to bring to the family if we can all just sort of step back a bit and just honor what they are and what they bring.
There's a very important point, I think, many, many important points in what you're saying, and one of them is that if children are problem-solving all the time, they have increased confidence, and that confidence is based in real things in the real world, and they bring that to testing. So if you're even if you are focused on testing, a confident child is going to do better.
Well, I get tickled sometimes, and this can happen, you know, whether you're standing in line to get an ice cream cone or wherever. It has become so trendy for people to say good job to kids. Good job, you know. And it is important to pat kids on the back. It's so important to give them concrete praise. So if I can say to you, Mary Charlotte, you know, that was a wonderful paragraph that you wrote, and I want to read more. You know, I really love your voice on the page. That's much more helpful, I think, to you than just perpetually vaguely saying, well, good job.
Or giving them a trophy for having passed the second semester of first grade or something.
Right.
Yeah, it's true, and there is that kind of overdoing it, because, I mean, kids aren't stupid, and if you are praising them falsely, they know that, and it's very confusing.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, I was really interested, because it's a book of letters, as you know, so it's 14 letters, and the letter is written to this educator. You know,
did you have somebody in mind? Did you have a particular person in mind when you were writing it?
You know, someone said to me early on in the project, well, think of some kind of teacher, as we say today, you know, sort of this microcosm. I did think of a couple of people who are themselves very creative and who are very committed to being just outstanding educators. And as I say through the book, I've had the privilege around the country of watching amazing librarians and amazing professors and amazing teachers who really create a climate, you know, that lets students of whatever age, graduate students or little ones, you know, just blossom. I can remember being in Princeton some years back, and I was visiting the class of a very creative third grade teacher, and her students all firmly believed they were poets. They couldn't imagine not thinking it. And they all had a poet notebook in their back jean pocket, which they would flick out and say to me, you know, when I have an idea, I just jot it down.
Right.
Well, I visit many other classrooms where kids feel, no, we're not poets.
Right.
You know, we don't know how to do that.
And it's amazing also how one sentence by one teacher can squelch you. And I mean, I had that experience in the ninth grade. I wrote a poem, and I took a long time doing it. And the teacher wrote the word trite, and I never wrote a poem again.
And I have a couple of those stories in the book, including, you know, some by professors. I remember one, I think she was in Wisconsin, who had just published a book of poems. She was teaching poetry, to, you know, at the college level. And she said to the students in my presence, as I've told you before, my first college paper had a W on it for worthless.
Right.
Now, you don't get over that.
You
know,
you
that
don't.
Voice is always there.
And it's also, I mean, I think when you're an adult, one of the things you forget is that for children, there's a lot of formative experiences happening all the time. If somebody told you, Pat Mora, right now, author of innumerable books, you're worthless, you would probably feel bad for a half an hour, laugh it off, and keep on going on with your work. But when that happens to somebody who's 6 or 12 or even 21, it's not like that.
And I heard examples of just that kind of thing this week, you know, with a family member, Mary Charlotte. And you're absolutely right. The power of words said and the power of words unsaid. You know, when a young person just needs that, you know, that professor or that teacher to say something positive. Also, you know, as a Latina Chicana writer, I'm interested in that sort of broad support that isn't tied to skin color or economic level, that sees the potential, you know, in all kinds of students at all levels. And we have a long way to go sometimes with that.
Well, and as we've seen in so many different cases of young people who were liberated by art or by poetry or spoken word, the people with some pretty tough backgrounds, they find their strength in their creativity.
Right, and that can be in a science classroom. It can be in a math classroom. But it does take, I think, you know, when I talk about that first one, that you have to accept your creative self. Last week, I had the privilege of talking to a group of women who have all been involved with acequias in New Mexico. And they were getting together to talk about the possibility of putting together a book that would have recipes and then their stories connected with the recipes. So I talked about Zing a little bit, and I spoke about the importance of, you know, honoring your creative self. And in the conversation, they were so open, and there were varying ages, you know, in the group. So open about saying, in fact, one of them, a young woman, I'm going to say probably in her early 30s, and she said, oh, I really did not want to come today, because when I read that we were going to have to do something on paper, my whole chest just tightened up, you know, and you could see it on her face.
Yeah.
As she spoke, though, she had these fabulous family stories to tell, you know. And what I was saying to them is that, you know, we all have unique stories. Even if you have three sisters, each one of the sisters has a different version of what happened that Thanksgiving, you know. So we all have unique stories to tell. If we can first, and, you know, that's what the book is about, if we can first begin by believing in ourselves and then, you know, adopt sort of the practice of giving ourselves time to develop that creative side.
We're talking to Pat Mora about her new book, Zing, 7 Creativity Practices for Educators and Students. The next chapter in the book is about enjoying quiet. The subtitle is Create Quiet Spaces for Students. Now, quiet spaces, that's something that, I mean, I was thinking about that in terms of, again, my own childhood, which seems ever more remote. There was a lot of quiet. I mean, we didn't have a TV for a long time, and, you know, there was radio, but it wasn't on all the time. And at home, there was a lot of, like, that kind of time that you spend. I remember watching my hamster. You know, and the only sound was watching that hamster wheel squeak around and the little noises that that animal made and stuff like that and your dogs and what it was like outside. And it seems like because of the media environment, we're in a very noisy time right now.
Well, I think you were lucky to have that childhood. And I think I was too. And I think probably my 3 kids whose TV watching was also limited, you know, they experienced it too. Again, you know, as I travel, I can think of a school that I visited in Texas maybe 5 years ago. And not a single student in the school did not live in an apartment. And most of those apartments were very crowded with family members. How then is a fifth grader going to find quiet? And how is a fifth grader going to learn that, you know what, I kind of like quiet? And again, that's where part of the zing is the power of educators, you know, the power of parents as educators to help students, to help young people experience, you know, gee, it's kind of nice to sit outside and just be. But I think we have, to some extent, over-programmed kids. We are afraid that if they're still, they might get into trouble. Rather than thinking of ways to give them the space to hear themselves. Many times I meet people who are in their 20s, and, you know, when we're chatting, they would say, I don't know if I've ever heard myself. Between the radio, you know, TV, games, there are ways in which we almost protect ourselves from hearing ourselves.
Yeah. Well, and so what are some ways that educators can actually do that?
Well, I think one way is to create spaces in schools and, you know, and that's schools at all levels, where it's okay to be quiet. And I try to stress in the book, I'm not talking about the restrictive quiet of the old days where librarians were going shh, shh, shh all the time, but really just, you know, many places, for example, in elementary schools will have a reading corner with maybe a giant chair and stuffed animals where students, or they have them in libraries, places where, you know what, it's considered perfectly acceptable to just stretch out there and enjoy it. I think for parents, though, we have that responsibility too. You know, and sometimes it's, you know, I'm going to read my book. Do you want to sit here next to me and let's look at your book together? And then maybe we'll both read for a little bit to ourselves. Providing the opportunity to experience, you know, we model and we teach. And we can't expect young people to do what we don't model.
Yeah, exactly. Now, what is the value of quiet in terms of helping students cultivate their creative voices?
I think it takes quiet, even though particularly high school students would be very wary of this suggestion, you know, from me. But I think it takes quiet for your mind to begin to play. And I think creativity is about play, whether you're talking about, you know, science, math, a haiku, you know, playing with paint. You need that opportunity to play. And I think the best examples we see are kids playing by themselves in a sandbox or with finger paint, where they actually lose themselves in the process.
Losing oneself is a very important part of it. And I was thinking about that, too, when you were when I was reading this book, because there are some people who get into tremendous creative blocks, and they become very self-conscious. And in that process, I'm supposed to do this, I need to do this, I want to do this, I can't. They can't lose themselves because they're so conscious of what isn't happening and what isn't flowing.
And I think in part that comes from that weight that we carry to be productive, you know, that we are supposed to be doing. The just do it slogan at a certain point can become a fault. Because on the one hand, I want people to leap into whatever kind of work they want to do, you know, be it with paint or gardening or cooking or whatever. Of course, you need to leap into it. On the other hand, you need to be willing to mess around a little bit. And so I talk in the book, you know, how sometimes I'll just sit with a piece of paper and maybe I start out and I'm kind of doodling. I wish I knew how to paint. That might be one way to limber up. Sometimes I take a walk. You know, I like to walk. It's just a way of just letting ideas sort of rise up, you know. Just as dishes that we make have to simmer, you know, for
right.
The flavor to come through. So we need to give those ideas a chance to surface and simmer. And that process of being still and listening can make some people who are very production-oriented nervous.
It's interesting, too, because when you make the analogy to cooking and things like that, it's almost like, or it is like, creativity has its own physics in which things happen by themselves that you can't completely force or control.
That's a great insight. And there are, you know, examples in a lot of the sort of more scientific creativity literature, you know, about scientists who worked and worked at a project. So on the one hand, you must be willing to work. And then they just sort of quit for the day and they go off. And I think it was a story about one of Einstein's theories, you know. He steps on the bus and he gets it.
Yeah.
He has the answer.
There was some other, I forget whether it was a mathematician or a scientist, but it was somebody who had an insight while crossing the street, but because he had to watch out for traffic, he couldn't hold on to it, and he sort of forgot about it. And then the next day he said, something very important happened while I was crossing the street. And he goes back to it. I'm not sure if it was in physical reality or in his mind. Recreates it, and some big theory comes out of it.
Oh, that's an amazing story. Well, the mind is a complex, I mean, it is mysterious how it works. And we have to give it a chance to work. Yeah, the mind and heart.
We're talking to Pat Mora about her book, Zing, 7 Creativity Practices for Educators and Students. And I might add, anybody else.
Anybody else.
So the third piece of the program that you lay out for teachers is gather your materials and motivate your students to gather their materials. What does that mean?
I think we have all kinds of stories and ideas inside. And it is like, I don't sew, so I'll use that for an analogy. If I were going to make something, I imagine I would get my threads and my needles and my cloth out. I'm much more comfortable with cooking, so you know the French talk about, and I don't speak French, but that mise en place, where you get all your ingredients in front of you and you're ready to go. In the same way, in the process of developing the creative self, I think we have to begin creating what I called almost like a compost. These can be stories, they can be ideas, they can be fragments. You know, I'm very nosy, so when I'm at airports, I'm listening to conversations, I'm watching scenes. These all, if I take the time to write them down, and I can't say I'm meticulous about it.
You need a little poetry notebook
you
in your back
do.
Pocket.
I'm in my back pocket, exactly. I should learn from those kids. They become ways to avoid that moment when you look at the blank piece of paper or the canvas, or you're getting ready to compose a song or a dance, and you say to yourself, I don't know where to begin. So by having some material that you have gathered, you can begin to play in more concrete terms now. Well, I could use the purple cloth, and I have a pattern, and it might work with that, or would I like the pink one better? If I'm knitting, you know, I have all these different colors of threads. How would I like to combine them? I want to gather my material. I don't think that's any less true for writers. It can be, I'm going to take about 15 minutes and I'm going to read some poems that I love. And I'm going to let that love of that poetry kind of well up in me until I think, ooh, I want to do that. You know, I want to write. But I'm not going to write that. I'm going to write my stuff.
Exactly. And there's something that you talk about in the book a little bit, which is that when you're quiet, you can listen. And when you listen, things come to you, and things, it's almost like things are said to you. I mean, it's not like you're hearing voices exactly, but on some level, in the creative process, you're in a continual dialogue. You're not just doing it to the materials, but the materials are responding to you.
I think most authors would say that the writing process is such that you're not exactly taking dictation, as you were hinting, right? On the other hand, putting yourself in the presence of possibility. And we have a lot of, you know, very famous writers like Eudora Welty who would be there. And she said if an idea came through, she was there waiting for it. You know, she had her schedule. The need to sort of listen and act. And I talk about that in the book, you know, that there is a sort of, I don't want to call it passivity, but there is a quiet receptivity. And I think I use the example in the book, you know, like a...
fishing.
You are right. You're waiting for a tug on the line.
Yeah.
Right? You are receptive. Now, to be receptive, I have to be kind of quiet when I'm actually ready to create. You know, all the time I'm trying to be curious. I'm trying to take ideas in because, looping back to the first idea, I have begun to think of myself as a creative person. I haven't accepted the notion that the creative people are the people whose paintings hang at the museum, the people whose names I see on the book, the binding of the books, right? I have accepted the fact that I'm a creative person, and I'm kind of curious to see what I'm going to do and how I'm going to do it. So I'm both receptive, but also... you know, and we'll move to that practice then. I have to be willing to dive in and to leap in with gentleness to the self.
Right, because if you are too harsh too quickly, I mean, there's a moment for harshness. I mean, there's a moment for throwing away three quarters of something that you did and keeping the good one quarter or one tenth or whatever it is. But in the beginning, I mean, the next chapter is called, after gathering your materials, is begin your project. And beginning your project, for some, is daunting, and for some, that's the most fun part.
I was telling the women from the Acequias that when I first started, and I've been at this probably 30 years now, when I first started, time for writing, you know, I had been a teacher, I'd been a university administrator, I was a mom, I would play this game with myself. And I knew it was a game, but it worked. I would say, you never have to keep the first line. And that game allowed me not to sit there waiting for the perfect words.
Right.
The perfect words seldom come, not even in the last line. We are gentle with the self, I like to say. I never let myself say anything negative about my work. Other people may say plenty of negative things, and I have to realize that's going to happen. When I'm sitting there by myself, I'm trying to raise my curiosity level. So when I'm writing for little ones, for example, because I've done a lot of children's books, and people will ask, well, what are you thinking about? Well, it's almost as if I'm writing it with a child. Like, we're having a good time together, and I'm trying to imagine the scene and what we would say, and I'm so lost in that that I'm not thinking about, oh, that must be so stupid, or everybody's done this, this is such a silly idea. But I went through that stage, and the awkwardness of feeling, I'm going to sit down here, and I am going to try to write or paint or design a mural. It can be an awkward feeling for some people, and that has to be tolerated. And you have to reward yourself. You know, you have to say, hey, I sat there for 30 minutes, and I bet next time I'm going to sit there for an hour. Because once you produce some material, you're going to kind of like it. That's my experience. You're going to let the material become more important than your ego. And to the degree to which we are able to set the ego aside and have a good time with the material and become interested in, I'm going to use writing, in the best possible word, or do I want a conversation? Last year I did a book of teen love poems. It was one of the most joyous projects of my life.
Written by teens?
Written by me.
Oh!
Written by me in the voice of teens.
Oh my
goodness. You know, girls and boys. It's called Dizzy in Your Eyes, Poems About Love. Someone suggested the idea to me.
That's great.
And at first I thought it was sort of a wacky idea, and I said, oh, I just can't imagine it. But then I kind of got into it, and that's that wonderful moment when I think, oh, okay, so I can think of a scene. I did ask teens to give me ideas, and they were very generous. But then, you know, I'd be home, me and me.
And your teenage self, no doubt.
Well, that's it. And sometimes when people say, well, how could you have done it? Well, we were all teenagers.
Yeah.
I'm still a teenager, you know. I raised three teenagers, so it was fun, actually, to put myself in a situation. For example, I know how to swim, but I'm not a great swimmer. But I knew a young woman who was a great swimmer, you know, in California, and would get up at 6 in the morning. And I thought, well, what would it be like to be her? What would it be like to get in the water and feel, this is my other world? You know, this is the other world that I love. And to put myself there was really a wonderful experience for me.
Now, that's a very interesting thing. We're talking to Pat Mora about creativity practices. Putting yourself in somebody's shoes, that's what actors do, that's what novelists do, and many poets do. Is there a way that you can teach people to do that or help them to do that?
Being curious helps. My kids might say being nosy helps.
Let's call it curious.
So if I were going to write a poem about being someone who interviews writers and I were going to be Mary Charlotte, I would think to myself, well, so what does she feel before the person walks in? Does she think, well, what if she's kind of a grouch? Or what if she really, you know, her voice doesn't really lend itself to radio? And I would just begin to ask myself a series of questions about you. And that's how I would become more and more curious about you. Then I'd become more curious about your personal life. You know, how did you grow up? I mean, you've given me a few hints, you know. You and the hamster.
Right.
So that might be one of my favorite scenes, you know, that were you as in a little bit of abandon while the hamster was going round and round? Were you also in your own way as, you know, going round and round in your head and just enjoying that rhythm? And the rhythm would give me a good idea for the poem. And then I think, well, how could I capture that rhythm on the page? So it's just by creating questions for myself.
You know, as you're speaking, it's making me think about the distinction between curiosity and nosiness. When I was a little girl, I had a friend who, we went to the beach in the summer, and her mother sat at the entrance of the beach where everybody came in and commented on every single person going by and, you know, who they were and what their children were doing and what problems they had. And basically, she was the town gossip. And I don't think she really meant harm or evil by it, but it was very disconcerting because you knew that when you walked away that she was going to be talking about your parents or whatever. And I don't think there was any compassion in it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that curiosity on some level probably has to have some compassion and love in it in order for you to write about that person in an authentic way.
And you can imagine how with teens, any of us who have survived the teen years feel great compassion. There are many pressures on teens. They fascinate me. You know, as I said to them in the letter at the beginning of the book, their intensity fascinates me. And the highs and the lows and the fury, you know, and the way their hearts get broken. And I am interested in...
Which is not entirely unlike the way our hearts get
broken. Oh, no. In fact, one of the titles for one of the poems is Dumped. And I've told audiences that really it was inspired by listening to a librarian at a conference talking to fellow librarians and beginning her presentation by saying, I was dumped yesterday. And I immediately pulled out my notebook and wrote the word dumped because it's such a powerful word.
Yeah.
And she felt dumped and was brokenhearted in the same way that the teen that I wrote about who had been dumped. Yeah, humans are humans.
Yeah. Okay, so now we have valued our creative selves, enjoyed quiet, gathered our materials, begun our projects. The next thing is revision.
And this is where I always joke, all my student friends begin to frown. They hate the word revision. And I confide, you know, when I speak to students at all levels, I confide that I probably never liked it. And luckily, I went through school before people were having students do a lot of revision. We just didn't do it. So I'm totally sympathetic. I try to differentiate, though, between writing for ourselves and for our friends, and that's really valid and a wonderful gift, you know, for people to give to someone, to write a poem for someone's birthday or for a graduation or for a wedding, or to differentiate between that personal writing and writing that we would like to see published, and that's very different. That does require the willingness to rewrite, and then I confide the most ultimate horror to them that revision is my favorite part of the process.
Well, that, I mean, so many writers say that that's where the real writing happens.
I love the first draft, but it, in a way, it is a phase at this point in my life that I tolerate. It's getting ideas down on paper or getting the first sketch of the poem. You know, I'm curious, but usually with me, I've been letting the curiosity build, like I'm thinking of a new book of poems for adults. And so I'm letting the curiosity about these people who are going to be in the book build inside of me. There is a point when I will begin playing with their lives on paper. But the real thrill will be when I have those drafts and I think, now, how could I bump that level up? How could I make it, you know, a much more irresistible and rewarding experience for you, the reader, so that you love them the way I do?
Exactly. And there's, I mean, one of the things that's wonderful about the time we live in is that so many people have just decided to give their voices expression. And there's a ton of self-published stuff, and, you know, the internet is full of people's writings and blogs and all of that. And the reality is that most of it isn't really worth reading by people who are not your close friends or blood relatives. I mean, that's the way it is. And so getting from your first draft to something that is of universal or at least more than very small circle interest, that's a real job that takes a ton of discernment.
But I love the way you put that, because you first recognized that it is not that the writing doesn't have importance. Of course it has importance to friends, to family, you know, to this network that you've created.
Right.
On the other hand, is that going to appeal to enough people that it is going to be viewed as publishable by a publisher at a time when more and more publishers are skittish, you know, about new books? And the determination to make that last part of that journey, the revision, doesn't have to really be embraced at the beginning of a writer's life. I think at the beginning, the secret is to generate text, just as if I were going to work in mosaics. What would be important would be that I would generate many mosaics, because I am learning by experience. Ideally, I'm reading about how other people do it. Ideally, I'm looking at some really masters of mosaics, you know. So I'm becoming a member of this little community. One of the things that I stress a lot is that if writing is your interest, you need to be reading. You know, if painting is your interest, you want to be going to art shows, you want to be looking. And it's not that there isn't the rare genius who can succeed without going through that process.
Or maybe there's not.
Or maybe there's not.
Yeah.
But for most of us, you know, I mean, I draw great inspiration from the writings of others where I just, you know, I literally ache thinking, you know, how did she do that so beautifully?
And I think when you talk about that, it's important to stress how much of work, if you're going to do it in a serious way for publication, to try to make a living and things like that, is about craft. And you learn craft just the way a furniture maker learns craft. You don't just sort of sit around and in your dreams think of coffee tables. You learn how to make a coffee table, and writing and art and music are that way too.
Yet, and this is probably so important to me, I really want people to try. I don't want them to feel, well, you know what? I'm just not going to be able to do that, Mary Charlotte. I don't have that in me. You know, I'm so busy right now. I'm a mom. I have 4 kids. And you're asking me to develop my craft?
Well, and this is the thing also. I mean, we're talking about a number of different things. And one of them is what it takes to be a published writer. And the other is what it takes for students to put that pencil to paper or to get their voice out in one way or another.
Or for...
And even if they're never going to be a famous writer.
Exactly. Or for, and I'm a mom, so I'm going to use a lot of moms as examples. I can think of a woman I heard once who said that she would write these letters to her sons, and they never commented on them. And she always found it a little off-putting because she was telling them sort of their family history and their family stories. And then one time one of her sons became a judge, and he stood up and he read one of these letters. She did not realize he had ever even kept it, you know, or even read it. So that sense that, and I say this particularly to women, because I think women can suffer from particular self-doubts sometimes.
You think?
I think. I think. And so I want them to feel, you know, I do have a unique life. I've learned quite a bit. Maybe I want to write science fiction. It doesn't even have to be about my real life. But I just want to take a little time and write this down. And maybe it'll be my children or my great-grandchildren or my nieces or my students. I just want people to experience, I guess, what I think are the rewards and the life enhancement of developing their creative selves.
We're talking to Pat Mora. I was in Bali, Indonesia last year, and one of the things that was amazing to me was, at least in the city where we were, which was called Ubud.
Ooh, I was there once too.
Yeah, I saw that in your book.
Yeah.
Everybody seems to be a musician, artist, or dancer, or more than one of those things, and you see these little 3-year-olds with metal hammers and knives carving wood, and by the time they're 10, they can carve these dragon things that most of us couldn't even dream of doing. And, you know, I saw this first grade class playing a gamelan ensemble with incredibly complex interaction and syncopation and all of these things. And because it's an artistic culture, it's assumed that everybody can do it, and therefore everybody can do it. And what it would be like to have more of that here, and to have that kind of just assumption of everybody's creative participation being something that rules our lives.
And it's sort of an openness, isn't it? That people are open to that possibility. In an early one of my books of nonfiction, titled Nipantla, actually published by UNM Press, the last essay in it is titled A Poet for President. And I say that most people would just laugh at the notion, because we think of poets as people who foam at the mouth. That we have very...
We do?
Many people do. We have very narrow definitions sometimes, you know, in U.S. culture. If I'm a lawyer, is it going to surprise you that I play in a band at night? Probably. Because we have definitions of what professionalism is. So I agree with you that if we could embrace our more complex selves. I think what happens is we can be so judgmental so that, for example, if we had someone running for governor who happened to say, well, yes, you know, and I'm also a salsa dancer, the public tends to get a little nervous because, again, I think we have these very prescriptive and narrow definitions.
I'd vote for them.
Yeah, I know you would. That's why I used it.
Well, think of Václav Havel. He was a poet and President of the Czech Republic. Think about Pablo Neruda. He was a politician and poet.
Do we think it could happen here? I don't know.
I don't know. I mean, it is a... Well, and this is the thing. So here you are, Pat Mora, offering these ideas for young people, for teachers of young people, which has the potential to be really transformative. Because when you have young people... and lots of them embracing their creative selves, they take that into everything they do, whether they enter politics or anything else.
Nursing, right? Whatever. We want people around us who are going to be active in our lives to be creative, not just following a bunch of rules.
Exactly.
But that's what we tend to reward.
So the last part of the book, the last couple of chapters, are about sharing your creations and persisting in your work. So sharing in your creations, as you mentioned at the beginning of the program, that's a block for some people, too, who've been closet writers but never let it out there.
And I can remember how I felt that way. You know, when the first time someone said to me, well, could I, you know, and by then I was an adult, I was a mom, and someone said, well, could I read some of your work? And I looked at him and thought, well, you know, are you deranged? Do you really? And he said, well, how is it going to get any better if you don't let anybody read any of it? It goes back to that willingness to set ego aside a little bit so that if I wrote a poem for you for your birthday on January 19th, that
which is the same as your birthday,
that I would want to feel, but even if it's not a wonderful poem, I want to give it to Mary Charlotte. So I suggest in the book, and the suggestions are as much for teachers and professors as for students, you know. I was at a campus in California where a group of the professors had decided that they really did, you know, some of them wrote fiction and nonfiction and poetry, and that they were going to have sort of a little coffee or, you know, reading for the rest of the faculty. Now, that could be very intimidating to some faculty members who, again, have a persona. I'm a specialist in medieval Spanish history. Do I really want them to see the kind of wacko poem that I wrote?
And what if they're horribly critical and don't respect me as much and all that?
Yeah. It goes back to those narrow definitions. Okay. In sharing, though, which we always encourage young people to share, and I think as adults we have to do some of that sharing too, and I stress that through the book, you know, for faculty to share what they have written. And that gives our students the courage to share what they have written, because we're all in a community.
We've only got a minute left. Do you do workshops? Do you teach? Do you go to the schools, for example, and teach young people and teachers how to do this?
I do some. You know, a lot of my life is spent on planes, frankly. I have a literacy project, you know, the El Día de los Niños, El Día de los Libros, that celebrates its 15th anniversary this coming April.
Nice.
So I'm often speaking at conferences. I do workshops also. I mean, I do. But often it is really talking about sort of these broader literacy issues. But I'm delighted at the interest you have taken in the creativity part of this work.
Well, Pat Mora is the author of the book Zing, 7 Creativity Practices for Educators and Students, which I guess is now available at Collected Works Bookstore.
Right, and I'm grateful to them.
And she is also at patmora.com. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe at the start of this new school year.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte, and for your really perceptive questions.
Thank you. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org. Podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.